Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Rogue to a Void by Bianca Blythe, narrated by Angela Daw. Prologue. Letters to the Editor. Matchmaking for Wallflowers, October 1816.
Dear distributors of drivel, it has come to my attention that I have been featured yet again on the top 10 lords to land. Please let me assure the readers, and whomever this secret editor is, that I do not wish to be on this list. I am gratified that you believe that my shoulders have a breadth more commonly seen in sturdy farmhands, and that you are willing to overlook my inability to tie an elegant cravat. It is kind of you to suggest that I could simply pay an extensive visit to Beau Brummel after marrying, and that, even if I prove to be a lost cause, my symmetrical features might make their way to the second generation. I urge the unmarried women of the Ton to please remove me from your lists of potential husbands, even if you are aware of a miraculous linguist who can tackle my rough accent and are capable of burning all my kilts. Despite this magazine's belief that I might make someone an, if not ideal, at least tolerable match, despite my unsavoury origins, I would like to state that I am not interested in making any match at all. Gerard Highgate, Marquis of Rockport, Scotland.
Matchmaking for Wallflowers, November 1816.
We were delighted to receive personal correspondence from Lord Rockport. His lordship's sense of humour, even when directed at us, is a delight, and we have moved him to the top of our list of lords to land. We encourage all young ladies to travel to Scotland to trap this elusive aristocrat. Arm yourselves with a copy of Waverley, Lord the dull-coloured Highland Peaks that our Scottish neighbours extol with such inexplicable and incessant raptures, and you will find yourself wed by the end of the season.
Matchmaking for Wallflowers, Letters to the Editor, December 1816.
Dear scribblers of silliness, while I am cognizant of the supposed honour bestowed on me by crowning me the top lord to land, I can assure you of my continued resistance to having anything to do with a pamphlet so plenteous in prattle. The peace I cherish in Scotland has been marred by a sudden preponderance of marriage-minded Englishwomen and their calculating mamas. While some gentlemen have assured me that I have been awarded the ultimate adulation, I am aware of the darker sides of this babble-infested booklet, and my newfound position has not made me succumb to the flattery to which so many of my peers surrender. Recently, the new Duke of Alfriston was gleefully maligned in these pages. I wonder at the sanity of my English neighbours who take pleasure in promoting such arbitrary yet vigorously followed advice. Who wields such ill-deserved influence? I feel duty-bound to announce to the less-informed souls, who seem to comprise the entire population of Mayfair, that I have become aware that Lady Cordelia Haywood, daughter of the Duke of Belmont, is a contributor to matchmaking for Wallflowers. Let me remind the Ton that though her ladyship might be in possession of some faint beauty, she is devoid of a single quality to qualify her for writing articles on the vastly overrated art of decorum and etiquette. This charmless chit was betrothed to three dukes, a number never equalled by any other debutante, a fact that should be cause for shame, not celebration, for her ladyship and her rumour-riddled family. It would not surprise me if she had composed the condescending articles on the Duke of Alfriston's missing leg herself. I urge you to stay away from foolish pamphlets, stay away from foolish chits, and by God, stay away from Scotland. This Scotsman values his peace.
Matchmaking for Wallflowers, Letters to the Editor, January 1817.
We pride ourselves on our anonymity. The maintenance of etiquette occurs with the most reliability when it is felt as an all-seeing, all-knowing, and always mysterious presence. Miss Cordelia Haywood has been removed as a contributor, and our readers are once again urged to follow the art of decorum stringently, lest they find their misdeeds reported for the benefit of others. It should also be noted that Lord Rockport was entirely undeserving of this treasured pamphlet's praise, and has been removed from the list of lords to land. This rogue is one to avoid.
Chapter 1. Yorkshire, April 1817. Lady Cordelia fluttered her fan, though the ballroom hardly qualified as warm, or perhaps she'd simply never spent a ball sitting down.
Thick Yorkshire accents rumbled around her and merged with the notes of poorly tuned violins. Guests clumped their slippers over the stone floor, and women swirled in murky blue and brown dresses. Most gowns seemed hastily modified from several seasons past, though some seemed as if no one had even attempted to rectify their unfashionable lines. The guests' faces were flushed. Their eyes sparkled with vivacity normally seen on jeweled tiaras. They changed dance partners with an exuberant frequency, and not a single person had asked Cordelia to dance. Cordelia kept her torso at the 90-degree angle her governesses had advocated. Unfortunately, the gesture did not compel any of the plethora of gentlemen to ask her to dance, despite the adamant assurances of her numerous etiquette books that men found rigid postures desirable. She resisted the urge to tap her foot as the music switched to a popular melody. The joyful notes might be crescendoing, but she couldn't permit anyone to think her unhappy. She desired no one's sympathy. Perhaps the gentlemen simply were unaware of her status, or perhaps they found her beauty intimidating. Blonde hair, blue eyes, and rosebud lips might overawe some people, especially when the locks in question were glossy, the eyes large and wide, and the lips exquisitely shaped. More than one ardent suitor had compared her eyes to azure skies seen in the art of Renaissance masterpieces. But that had been before. The guests continued to prance over the floor, and the men continued to ignore her. It was almost as if... The thought was impossible, and she took a lengthy sip of her orgeat, despite her lack of affection for the cloyingly sweet taste and the unlikely pairing of almonds and oranges. She couldn't be a wallflower. She simply couldn't be. That was a fate for other women, ones with smaller dowries and educations at less vigorous finishing schools. Cordelia scanned the ballroom again. But unlike in her favorite Loretta Van Loken novels, no charming prince weaved his way through the crowded assembly rooms. Which, come to think of it, was utterly fine. Dancing meant being on display, and despite her mother's habit of dragging her to the finest dressmakers, Cordelia favored being away from the scrutiny of people she was beholden to impress. Her mother frowned at her from behind the silver punch bowls and rows of crystal glasses. Cordelia raised her hand to her locks, prepared to brush away any loose strands, but her hairstyle was immaculate. She smoothed her dress, but the sumptuous fabric was unstained and devoid of wrinkles. Her gown remained impeccable. People should be dancing with her. Last season the men had begged her for the honor. She scoured the groups of assorted men again. Most avoided her eye contact. Enraptured in their own conversations, they were likely discussing cricket and cigars. One man smiled, and his legs shifted in a manner that implied he might be considering crossing the ballroom floor to see her. It was Orlando Filby, a man she hadn't glanced at in her last season, though now she wanted to embrace him for even considering approaching. Perhaps she might even venture to smile. Just as she contemplated whether the action verged on the overly flirtatious, the man beside him firmed his expression and gestured in her direction. The other man, one Cordelia had never been introduced to, but who clearly knew all about her, for he kept looking her way as he whispered into Philby's ear. Philby's smile vanished, replaced by a now familiar mixture of suspicion and surprise, the sort that always seemed to appear when men heard of her story. Smoke stung her eyes. She'd chosen a corner near the fireplace, yet the warm flames irritated her. She should move, but right now the prospect of marching through the ballroom, making it clear to everyone that no one desired to dance with her, seemed horrendous. Giggles sounded beside her. Wallflowers. Most of them were new debutantes. Maybe no man desired to dance with them, but they had each other. She considered joining them, but they leaned toward one another, covering their mouths with their fans. Gracious! They were chatting about her. She strove to retain her composure. She was supposed to be a hostess. She was supposed to have joined society's finest matrons. She was supposed to be preparing for an heir and five spares. She was absolutely not supposed to be a wallflower. After all, she was the daughter of a duke, the only daughter of a duke, and not the type of duke desperate for money, with only a crumbling estate and some maudlin tales of his family's tumble from prosperity. Her father's wealth was renowned. In fact, others even approached him for loans. Her father might be distant. He might not speak to her often, but at least no one doubted his importance. The new debutantes didn't relate to her. They'd clearly heard rumors of her snobbery, and it was true. She didn't enjoy speaking to people at these events. But there was nothing personal about her dislike. She didn't desire to speak to anyone, not really. She wasn't snubbing anyone with her shortened answers and her unease at inquiring about someone's health. Someone needed to fulfill her parents' ambitions, and nothing would happen if she abandoned her focus. The smoke continued to sting her eyes, and she swallowed hard and forced her features to relax. Men did not desire women with sour expressions, and she strove to keep her countenance placid. After all, what could be more pleasant than spending hours preparing for a ball and then spending the entire time sitting in a corner? At least her immaculate coiffure was bound to remain immaculate. No ridiculous jostling to disturb the carefully pinned curls. Quite ideal, really. It was a wonder that Matchmaking for Wallflowers hadn't already published an article on the fashion merits of being a wallflower. And now she wouldn't be able to submit one. A woman plopped down beside her and raised a bare hand toward her chest. Her hair was pulled in a stringent bun, devoid of any attempt at elegance, and her gown was somewhat damp, as if she'd dressed hastily.
"Oh, my!"
Cordelia blinked. The woman's nasal pronunciations, a regrettable talent mastered only by Americans, explained her lack of fashion expertise, even though it did not excuse it. Cordelia hadn't approved of those former colonists before the Duke of Alfriston humiliated her, and she certainly did not approve of them after. Perhaps His Grace would never have abandoned her if his mother and two younger sisters did not live in Massachusetts, and he had never visited the land of rough-spoken insurgents with their misguided notions of individuality. Likely this woman would have taken pleasure in tormenting Britain's navy, aiming cannons on their ships' sumptuous shapes and mutilating sailors with the inevitable splinters. Cordelia had read the reports. The woman brushed aside a loose tendril, plastering it to her forehead in an unbecoming fashion.
"I'm out of breath. The spinning, the jumping, the—"
"There is no necessity to explain the mechanics of dance," Cordelia retorted. The woman halted, and she widened her nondescript eyes. "I mean, I've danced before. I know the process." Cordelia did not have to stoop to the behavior of Americans, no matter how absurd the fact that men asked this woman to dance and not her.
"I haven't seen you dancing."
"Ah." Cordelia attempted a languid sigh, but it seemed to have caught in her throat, likely with her good sense and respectability. She would not let this woman pity her. "I'm new to the region."
"I am as well."
The woman interrupted her with a customary enthusiastic rudeness Cordelia often noted in Americans.
"I rather gathered by the irregular length of your vowels," Cordelia said.
"That's what everyone says. What's your name?"
The woman stretched her lips into a wide grin, an expression typically seen on over-friendly children, and Cordelia found herself smiling back.
"Lady Cordelia Heywood, my father is the Duke of Belmont. And you are?"
"Oh."
The woman's smile faltered, and her freckled face, clearly America lacked knowledge of the wonders of lemon juice and buttermilk concoctions, paled.
"Truly?"
"I wouldn't pretend."
"Who would want to?"
The woman's face reddened.
"Oh, dear, please forgive me. I'm Louisa Carmichael."
"The Duke of Alfriston's sister."
Cordelia's voice wobbled.
"Yep,"
the woman said miserably. She didn't add that she'd almost been her sister. She didn't need to.
"I should speak to my brother now."
Miss Carmichael rose abruptly.
So good to meet you."
Miss Carmichael tripped over the hem of her dress and nearly tumbled to the ground before scampering away. Cordelia wouldn't have tripped. She never tripped. She was flawless. She was also a wallflower. Gerard Rockport, Marquess of Highgate, had contemplated death before, but he'd never imagined he'd succumb to that fate while holidaying in the Yorkshire Dales. That thought seemed less ridiculous now. Early evening horse rides were meant to be reserved for those members of the ton who withstood the temptations of drink and gaming houses, and yet Gerard was distinctly being followed by a man who embraced those vices. Huxby Ogleton weaved between trees some distance away,
Ogleton had never expressed an interest in the countryside, much less for a landscape only obtained after a grueling multi-day coach ride from the capital. Suspicious. Forcing aristocrats to pay gambling debts in murky passageways, aided by a plethora of elaborate knives, seemed more Ogleton's style. Everyone whispered that Ogleton had murdered Lord Templeton. Everyone whispered that Lord Morgan's three missing fingers stemmed from an encounter with Ogleton, though the poor man had refused to speak on the incident. Gerard lacked certainty of many things in the world, and that uncertainty had lately increased, but he was absolutely certain that Huxby Ogleton did not canter on a horse at a time when public houses were open. Especially not when he was heading in the opposite direction of those great designated venues for gin and ale. Most suspicious. No, Ogleton was most certainly not admiring the view and the long tangerine and lavender strips that reclined across the sky. He was not exercising his horse and noting the appearance of wildflowers sprinkled in the crisp green grass of the amply watered fields, nor was he admiring the pink rays splattered against the surfaces of majestic trees.
"Oi!"
a harsh voice barreled through the air. Gerard glanced over his shoulder, and Ogleton waved a bulky arm. The man's muscular neck throbbed, and his face scrunched into a familiar glower. Perhaps Ogleton wasn't addressing him. Perhaps his imagination had conjured Ogleton up completely. Gerard focused his attention on the view. Moss-covered stones hunkered along the road, and pastel blossoms rustled from the tree branches. The gelding clomped its hooves over the dirt lane, and he inhaled. Today was the pleasant sort of day he most enjoyed. Definitely not a day for dying.
"Lord Rockport!"
the man barked, and his baritone voice thundered over the merry chirps of warblers and robins. That probably was an indication Ogleton was indeed addressing him. Gerard sighed and inclined his gaze in the man's direction. Ogleton narrowed his eyes, and his bushy brows snapped together like a cannon being prepared for fire. Gerard veered his horse toward Ogleton, but his approach didn't lessen the man's scowl.
"You owe money."
Ogleton's craggy face furrowed in an expression of such distaste that Gerard might have believed the man had personally lent him every last tuppence. That hadn't been the case. At all. Ogleton's face darkened into a purple shade more often found on sumptuous silks from the Orient.
"You were supposed to repay the Duke last week. I'm sorry."
The words felt uncomfortable on Gerard's tongue, but he forced himself to utter them. He was sorry. Despite everything, he was. He was always apologizing for his late mother's sins and striving to keep the matter secret from his two half-brothers. He wished she'd confided in him about her debts, and that he'd had the opportunity to convince her she didn't need to go to Belmont for coin. Yet it was no wonder that she had charged him with executing her will and handling her debts. She knew his opinion of her would be forever marred by that holiday in Kent. Gerard sighed.
"I sent a note to inform His Grace that I would require the deadline to pay the loan to be extended."
Ogleton's eyebrows soared upward, and he snorted.
"His Grace ain't the type to have notes change the course of justice. I've got to show you just what he's capable of. An example for all the other debtors."
Ogleton removed a long carving knife from his coat, and an absurd urge to laugh filled Gerard. The metal glinted in the sunlight, and Ogleton stroked the handle, which did, to give the man credit, seem to radiate luxuriousness. Ogleton was just the sort of man to take an interest in knives.
"His Grace can have the money at harvest season. 4 months, you must be mad!"
Ogleton chuckled.
"You should have repaid 2 days ago. That's when the loan was due." "That loan never should have been made,"
Gerard said.
"I only discovered it after my mother's death. No one would have thought she had that money."
Ogleton hardened his gaze, and he spoke with a deliberation that Gerard imagined the man's teachers might have appreciated.
"You better not be besmirching the financial acumen of His Grace. I imagine there might be some flexibility. I've been in Scotland, but I was hoping to arrange a meeting with Belmont. His Grace did not achieve his position by displaying patience."
Ogleton tilted his stocky figure closer to Gerard, and the scent of gin wafted over Gerard.
There's a penalty for late payments. A finger for each day you're late. That's balderdash. So is failing to repay vast debts. I am a marquis,
Gerard announced.
And I demand you halt your absurd demands. You're a Scottish marquis who rarely makes an appearance in London. The Duke's got you beat on respectability.
Ogleton leered and flashed jagged yellow teeth. He tapped the ivory handle of his knife.
I ain't jesting. Now give me your hand.
Gerard paused. He'd heard the rumours about Ogleton. The man wasn't the sort to bluff. He'd likely never told a joke in his life, or laughed at one.
We're in the open, and I have a bloody reputation. No one is about.
Ogleton shrugged.
It's a pity you favour the remoter parts of Britain. Damned unpleasant ride up here, too. Quite hampering to my mood.
Gerard sighed. Staring at the Serpentine with all the tawn beside him had never given him sufficient stimulation, and though Scotland was bloody nice this time of year, it was bloody nice any time of year. He'd leaped at his half-brother's invitation to visit him and his new family. Now he was in England, and the Duke had clearly sent someone to greet him. Gerard tightened his fingers around his horse's reins. The breeze was pleasant, the sunset striking, and there was no way in all of Hades he would allow this man to dampen it.
Go!
Gerard roared, and dug his stirrups against his horse. For a glorious second, Ogleton's face crumpled. The horse galloped, and his hooves pounded against the tan-coloured path. The wind pummeled Gerard's attire and rippled the horse's mane with ferocity befitting their augmented speed. Loud trotting sounded behind him, and Gerard squeezed his thighs around the beast. Anyone who saw him might think him a typical tawn member racing his horse, albeit with a rapidity over the looping country road that verged on the inconsiderate. He steeled his jaw. The horse didn't seem unduly stressed. The animal actually enjoyed galloping. Fortunately, he didn't know one of the most notorious scoundrels in England was pursuing him. Gerard steered the horse toward the grey stone cottages and hilly roads of Harrogate. Perhaps the presence of other people might impede even Ogleton's bloodthirstiness. Even Ogleton must know the Duke didn't really want Ogleton to murder him. After all, Gerard was the Marquis of Rockport. He couldn't just have some fingers removed without consequence. Horse hooves thundered behind him. Gerard squelched thoughts of Lord Templeton's death, and the mangled body the broadsheets gleefully replicated. The gap between the buildings narrowed, and stately carriages rolled over the cobbled streets. They halted before a particularly magnificent home, judging from the immaculate façade. Gerard scrambled off his horse and tied the gelding to a tree. He neared a wall and clambered over it, not his most dignified moment, but dignity didn't involve a scruffy man chasing him either. Ogleton's reputation for destruction was pristine. He needed a place to hide, blast it. And where better than in public? Chamber music streamed from an open window, and women in lavish dresses, festooned with ribbons and lace, glided through the doors of the imposing building. Gerard doubted his buckskin breeches counted as appropriate evening attire, even in the most liberal interpretation. Nevertheless, he headed toward the partygoers. Chapter 2 Gerard shoved his way to the start of the queue, where an imposing white-wigged man greeted the guests. The butler's poised expression firmed, but Gerard pushed past.
"Sir!"
A deep voice boomed behind him, summoning a force normally associated with drums leading troops into battle, and Gerard's lips swerved upward. He'd underestimated the butler's capability for noise. He ignored the plea and brushed past lassies and top-hat-festooned county squires. Nondescript bags, no doubt stuffed with dance slippers, dangled from bare hands. In London, the hands would be gloved. This wasn't Almack's, no matter how much outrage the butler mustered. Gerard avoided balls at the best of times, a task easier at his estate in Scotland. Even the most determined hostess was flummoxed at how to achieve some semblance of a substantial guest list in that rural area. Partygoers streamed into an adjoining room. Gold letters shimmered from auburn and forest green leather tomes lined on neat shelves, and the gentlemen contorted themselves into awkward positions to exchange their hessians for slippers. Gerard strode over the aged floorboards, and his boots clinked a pleasant rhythm. He neared large wooden doors and thrust them open. The music intensified, and rows of people swayed in geometric patterns.
Gerard's foot twitched, and he lengthened his paces. He brushed off some of the grass and leaves that clung to his boots and grinned. He was the most underdressed man at this blasted event. Most men wore their hair in queues, tied in stark black ribbons. His coif was decidedly more wild, and white flecks dotted his frock coat. Apparently riding at a full gallop in the middle of spring was not without its wardrobe mishaps. More than one set of eyes widened at his entrance, and he didn't bother to swallow his grin. People tended to notice when he stepped into a room, and he enjoyed the novelty of seeing disapproval flicker over their carefully powdered faces.
"Sir!"
A footman, one of those rosy-cheeked blonde ones who seemed to be always likened to cherubs, approached him.
"Come to welcome me?"
Gerard winked.
"No."
The lad swallowed, and his Adam's apple hit against his ruffled cravat, the style even surpassing the old-fashioned attire found at court. He gestured vaguely toward the floor.
"This is clean, sir. Splendid!"
Gerard clapped his hands. The man's cheeks reddened.
"You're wearing riding boots."
"Ah,"
Gerard said.
"Come to compliment them. Rather nice of you. Never was one for ruffles and silk. There's a reason I'm never at court."
"You should wear..."
"Slippers." Gerard knew he wanted to say slippers, but he hadn't brought his dance slippers with him. Somehow he hadn't felt required to haul them on his post-dinner horse ride. He glanced in the direction of the door, half anticipating to see Ogleton's bulky figure barge through the crowd. The man wasn't there, but that didn't mean Gerard was going to wait for his appearance. Ogleton was too skilled to not be able to determine where Gerard had gone.
"Sorry, lad."
He clapped the footman's shoulder and wound his way through the throng of guests. The footman might not have succeeded in barring him from the ball, but he hoped they would do a better job at denying entry to Ogleton. Gerard marched deeper into the ballroom. Flames blazed in the fireplace, and he headed toward the mantel. After riding about in the cold, he wanted to get warm, quickly. Black-suited footmen carried silver platters with appealingly piled food toward the banquet tables. Perfect. Gerard seized an appetizer from the tray. Perhaps he didn't remember his father, but he would make use of the height the man had bestowed on him. The venison was splendid, and he grabbed a goblet. He favored proper whiskey to the ridiculous concoctions found at balls. There must be 10 different ingredients in this one. Elderflower and thyme were both better off garnishing meats than spirits. Fleeing for one's life rather affected his appetite and thirst. A footman turned to him. His features lacked the angelic appearance of the footman by the door. Clearly the butler had tasked the most imposing man to oversee the food. The man's eyes hardened, his lips cascaded down, and he tipped his nose skyward, as if he found the prospect of speaking with Gerard debasing. Perhaps the man thought himself intimidating, though after spending time being chased by a knife-wielding Ogleton, Gerard fought to suppress a laugh at the man's attempt at a grimace. He stuffed a second treat in his mouth and savored the gamey taste.
"You should try one."
"I must ask you to leave."
The footman's pale face purpled, his tray shook, and the sound of dishes clanging against silver filled the silence. Gerard sipped the alcoholic mixture. The bubbles might be growing on him, and he beamed, happy to be back in the warmth, safe from the finger-slashing maniac outside. Some guests halted their conversations, and Gerard inhaled their clashing perfumes as they thronged nearer him.
"A Doughty was invited,"
one person declared in a broad Yorkshire accent.
"How improper,"
a heavily jewelled woman murmured.
"Harrogate status is diminishing. I've never discovered dishevelled Scots in York's assembly rooms." "Though the man does look familiar," a younger woman said.
He grinned at her, noting her symmetrical features and well-placed curves. Strawberry blonde tendrils framed her face, and if he squinted, he might even imagine she possessed Scottish ancestors.
"I wouldn't mind becoming familiar with you." "Sir!"
Outrage permeated the man's voice, and the older woman grabbed the lassie's arm and marched away. Curious onlookers filled the empty space. The women fluttered their fans, as if they were at the Ascot and not observing an altercation.
"I must demand you leave."
The footman gave a pointed stare at Gerard's cravat.
"And not simply because your dress lacks the appropriate finesse."
To give the footman credit, the linen at his neck had rather come loose after his gallop through the fields.
"Are men's necks the new equivalent of ladies' ankles?"
Gerard handed the footman his empty goblet and tied the linen back into an expert knot, honed from years of practice in
Sample complete. Ready to continue?